In the deep dark, the Aslan are moving, but there is a darker power. There is something behind the claw.
Welcome to episode 5 of Behind the Claw. Shall we get started? I have no idea. So, computer, what can you tell me about this place? My galaxy is a segment where I spotlight one of the planets in the Tasesso subsector and give you an overview of it. A subsector map and UPPs can be found on the website at behindtheclaw.blogspot.co.uk. Sobafat is a relatively small world with a small population which only numbers a few thousand souls. There is no starport on Sobafat, and no real trade to speak of, there being too few people on the planet to support such enterprises. Sobafat was initially a small illegally planted colony. A small group of Imperial citizens unhappy with the Imperium broke away, heading for the edge of the Empire for a world to call their own. Up to the point that they arrived, this planet had been declared as uninhabitable due to the unbreathable atmosphere. However, that actually turned out to be good cover for the colonists, as it meant the planet would be easily overlooked. The atmosphere is unbreathable in its unfiltered state, due to a miasma of microbiological life. Although not directly poisonous to humankind, breathing the air unfiltered would soon lead to infections and disease. The locals use a locally manufactured breathing mask when outside, and these masks cover the mouth, nose, ears, and eyes. This is not the only protection used, as they also fit microwave flash burners in the housing airlocks. The population numbers only a few thousands. Although the birth rate on the planet could sustain a growing population, infant mortality due to childhood infections, probably down to the atmosphere, keeps the population numbers level. There are no restrictions on visitors, although local traffic control will designate certain landing areas for shuttlecraft. When the colony was discovered by the Imperial Scouting Service, control of the planet was handed over to the subsector capital. The inhabitants, however, were strongly opposed to Imperial rule, and a rebellion of sorts took place, but was quickly put down and a regent overseer put in place. Local laws now prohibit the owning and carrying of weapons, and this is strictly enforced by Imperial enforcers. There is little of interest to the visitor tourist, except for a single cave containing very old carvings of strange-looking spaceships. The carvings predate the establishment of the colony, and no investigation has discovered the source of the carvings, nor any other incident of similar carvings.
No way. The way I heard it is that he was shipping arms, guns, you know, taking them straight in, under the navvy's nose.
Here's a quick story seed, hopefully inspiring enough to allow you to set up a session. The players are hired to carry out an emergency rescue mission on a moon. The inhabitants of the moon are employees of an in-system corporation and their families. The company is using the low-G environment on the moon to manufacture low-tech but delicate algae matrices for use in air purifiers. A rogue asteroid is heading into the system, and it is predicted to hit this moon, and it is of such a size that it cannot economically be diverted. The impact is expected to shatter the moon and the asteroid. If the players accept the job immediately, they have enough time to evacuate the people with a couple of hours to spare. However, there are a number of complications. The system police patrol have been warned about the incoming asteroid and have been told to keep people away from the path of the moon. Unfortunately, these police won't believe or accept the existence of a rescue mission. The people on the moon live there. It is their home and they're attached to it. They will insist on saving some of the livestock from their farming domes. Additionally, scrap merchants or pirates are waiting to swoop in and to gather up what they can before the impact, and if the civilians or PCs get in the way, that'll be just too bad for them. Anyone investigating the asteroid before the impact will find it has kickers, that is, small thrusters installed on it, which have been used to direct it into this system. Their fuel is exhausted now, and anyway, even if they were refueled, it's far too late to redirect the asteroid away from the moon. 5 years ago, this asteroid was put into motion using these kickers by a rival company. There you go. Hopefully that's enough to get you started.
No, sir. You may not dock here.
What the hell? I just made three jumps to get here.
Without permit 7C, you may not dock. Now move out to the holding line at 6,000 kilometres.
It's time to talk about some rules. For this segment, I flicked to a random page in the rule compendium and came across starship encounters. This caught my eye as it's a section that I knew about, but have literally never used. This is covered on page 35 of Book 2, Starships. All it is a random table of starship encounters that you can use when a ship jumps into a new system. You cross-reference the starport type in this system with a 2D roll, modifying the roll upwards if there are Navy or Scout bases in the system. The result will be one of a few different types of ship, possibly with a smaller ship alongside, like a slowboat or a pinnace. The options here are quite varied. The list includes a 200-ton free trader, a mercenary cruiser, liners, a patrol cruiser, or even a yacht. Some of these options in systems with lower levels of starport are marked with a P, indicating it's actually a pirate vessel. The rules suggest that the referee should interpret these results. Well, very kind of them. But you should consider meeting the free trader and swapping trade information, or meeting the local pirate patrol, or even waving to the passing liner. It occurred to me that this was the equivalent of walking into the local inn when playing Dungeons & Dragons. There's not a lot of info in this table, but that said, wandering monster tables don't tend to give you a lot of info either, and this definitely fits that sort of category. There is a hint that you could combine the results here with the reaction table in Book 3. That table varies all the way from violent, immediate attack through to genuinely friendly. This really adds some flavour to the encounter, and it can give you some refereeing mind tricks, something to play with. Imagine friendly pirates. Why are they friendly? Do they think you're one of them, or is it a plot of some sort, a plan? And what about the aggressive patrol ship that's supposedly keeping the place safe? What if they're being aggressive and attacking? What do they think you've done? So to sum it up, there's not a lot here, but what it is a cool little referee's resource. It'll enable you to possibly spice up just an ordinary jump. You know, they come out of jump and there's another ship suddenly there right in front of them. And of course, let the players do the rolling. Let them have the chance of nothing happening, or make it their fault if it turns out to be pirates that immediately attack. And yet again, it's another section of the rules that I've completely missed up to this point, but I'm going to make use of it from now on.
Ah, damn piece of junk! Who bought this anyway? No, don't you dare say it was me.
This is a review of the official Traveller Supplement No. 2, Animal Encounters. This 52-page booklet was part of the original Traveller and published in 1979. This review, however, is focusing on the currently available PDF version, and this PDF is based on a scan of a printed copy, and as things go, it's quite a good scan, clear and easy to read. There is only one piece of art in here, a small black and white, which looks like something that's been Lovecraftian inspired. Book 3 of Traveller, Worlds and Adventures, gave you a mechanism for building a random animal encounter table for any terrain on any world. If your players were going into marshy terrain on a small world, you could knock up an encounter table for that particular world and that particular terrain. The purpose of this supplement is to save you the bother of making up that table of animal encounters. After a brief introduction, the booklet quickly moves into a series of tables that form the meat of the book. It systematically presents a separate table for each terrain type on a small world with a thin atmosphere, then a small world with a standard atmosphere, and then a small world with a dense atmosphere. This slips into rinse and repeat for medium-sized worlds and large worlds. Each table caters for a random roll from 2 to 12. Each line gives you the bare statistics for an animal, except when you roll a 10, which describes an event. Each animal entry describes its type, its weight, its hits to unconsciousness, hits to kill, its armor, the beast's weapon choice, and its likelihood of attacking or running away, and finally its speed. Without Book 3, these tables would be of little use, as this supplement does not explain all of the terms it uses. For instance, if an animal on the table is an intermittent, what does that mean? If it attacks as teeth, what does that phrase actually mean? Fundamentally, each row is a stat block without any description or narrative detail. This is typical of the classic Traveller system. It leaves you a lot of open space for the referee to fill in the details, which either suits you or doesn't. I have mixed feelings about this scenario within this context. If I'm being supplied an encounter table for quick reference, they should be quick reference, with everything I need on them. But at the same time, this same table might apply to 1,000 worlds, and the same creatures should not be appearing on world after world. But what about those events I mentioned? They happen when you roll a 10. Overall, I like the idea. It adds good spice to what is effectively a wandering monster chart. For instance, one event says that a PC is attacked by a chameleon filter. You'll need to look up what those words mean. Another says grass fire seen on the horizon. Another that your vehicle breaks an axle. However, you'll have to try and avoid a broken axle 3 times on the trot, or it might get a bit samey. After iterating through the world atmosphere options already mentioned, the book goes on to give you a few more specific tables. 8 tables for various maritime locations, 2 for aquatic conditions, and 2 for vacuum worlds. Overall, I think it's fairly useful in situations where you haven't had time to create specific encounter charts of your own. You would have to avoid using these charts too often, though, because if your players visit a lot of worlds, they'd soon become stale. With 1,000,000 worlds, it would be almost criminal of the referee for every world to have a 12-kilogram flyer that attacks on 3+. You have nothing to lose by adding this to your classic Traveller collection, but it is by no means a required PDF, as you can get more variety by using the rules in Book 3.
Did you hear that? What the hell do you think it is? Is it dangerous?
It's time to delve into the creature catalogue. The rings around the planet Zephthantui are noted as being the home of an almost unique type of animal. The rings themselves are nothing unusual, icy rocks orbiting the planet in a series of concentric rings. For years, the existence of the life form called the aniform worm wasn't known, despite an estimated millions of them having been killed by the action of man. In the time leading up to the discovery, the rings were being mechanically mined by operations that were recovering the hydrogen from the ice. Many millions of tons had been crushed and rendered into fuel. The mining operations had been slowed by occasional explosive mechanical failures. A corporate researcher was investigating the incidence of unusual ice crystals that existed within some of the ring boulders, as these were suspected of being responsible for the failures. Anecdotal evidence suggested that this type of ice was the cause of the problem. His line of research was considering how the crystals could have been formed, and he was subjecting the ice to various sorts of heat and radiation, and he discovered the combination needed to cause an explosion. At this point, he examined the recordings he had made and discovered the aniform living within the icy rock. The aniform, which is named for the researcher who discovered it, is a transparent worm, roughly 2 meters in length with a circumference of about 12 centimeters. It resides within the ice and has a mostly static life and is easily overlooked or mistaken for the ice itself. It has a mostly static life, absorbing solar energy and extracting nutrients from the ice around it. Not much more is known about the animal, and is limited to supposition and, frankly, guesswork. Its lifespan is estimated to be in the region of millennia, so no longer-term studies have been possible. The explosions, noted by those studying the Anopham, appears to be how the animal breeds. The theory is that when the local sun sends solar flares towards the planet, this will trigger the Anopheums to explode, and thereby spreading their body parts amongst the other rocks of the rings to collide with and form new ice masses in which they somehow breed. Alternatively, the individual parts of the creature may simply use this process to divide, and the individual parts may continue to grow. Local authorities have placed a moratorium on the mining of the rings, although it is thought that some illicit mining is still taking place. With a moratorium in place, research has also ceased, as it was mining companies that were actually financing this research.
Have you got that feed ready?
Yep, feeding it through now.
Got it, thanks.
That net feed's got a weird name. What is it?
Whale song. The captain likes whale song?
For today's audio segment, I don't actually have any audio to play for you. I haven't been able to contact the person who's created this audio and get permission to use it, but I can tell you about the link. If you go to a website called tabletopaudio.com, basically what the chap's done here is create a series of 10-minute loopable ambient noise or music tracks. Each one has a particular theme, and I'm recommending today one called Orbital Platform. This is a free-to-download MP3, and it gives you the ambience, the feel that you're at a space station, effectively. It creates an ambient noise that you can play in the background while you're role-playing. This particular one gives you the sound of atmosphere processing. You can almost feel the air moving. There's a lot of bass machine noise. Perhaps that's the atmosphere processing or the anti-gravity machines in the background. I don't know. There's also a hint of a hushed tannoy announcement, so perhaps there's a shuttle departing or arriving. You do get the feeling that there's people in the background moving around, but they're not speaking loudly or audibly. It's more a feeling it creates with the ambient feel.
So I'm here. Why don't you tell me why you called?
The spacer in the corner booth. Don't stare at him.
I see him. Who is he?
The guy on the news vids.
Which news vids? There are thousands of channels.
Crookwatch.
Ah, I see.
This is a segment I'm calling People of Interest, and basically I'm highlighting somebody who could be an NPC within your game. It's unlikely that you've heard of Dr. Hilda Gianoff. The doctor's name is not known right across the whole of the Imperium, but it is known across a number of sectors. The doctor died well over 200 years ago, but has now become somewhat of a myth or a legend, to the extent that some now question if the stories are true, or indeed if the doctor ever existed. I can assure you that the doctor did exist. Imperial records show the doctor's birth, education, and employment history. The university where she taught computer science for 4 years even have a statue erected to her memory. So we can do away with any doubts about her having existed. The myth, if it is a myth, must relate solely to her achievements. So let's deal with those. The claim about Dr. Gianoff that has caused the controversy relates to a supposed breakthrough in computer technology. She claimed to have created a breakthrough in the speed and data capacity of computers combined with a huge reduction in physical size. This is something that every ship's captain and ship designer would welcome with open arms. The tonnage alone of a ship's computer is responsible for many problems. Not only do they weigh a lot, but they take up space. Every ounce and every inch saved would have huge cost implications. Gianoff claimed she could reduce these by 50%, thereby saving your average ship millions in fuel costs over its lifetime. On top of that physical saving, the doctor claimed to have developed a method whereby a computer could handle 20 or 30 programs simultaneously. With current technology limited to merely 5 or 6, this would have revolutionised computing. But this is where the controversy in the story appears. At the time, BIS were very interested in Gianoff's discovery, and made a big media splash about their negotiations with the university who owned the rights to the Doctor's work. But then the whole story went dark. For a year, there was nothing. Not a squeak in the press, neither the news broadcasts nor the scientific press. Then one scientific journal published an article by Giannov that was not under the university's byline. The article was very quickly withdrawn and all printings recalled, and the copies were then pulped. Why? The university eventually admitted that they had demanded the article not to be released, claiming it was giving away their intellectual property. What was in that article? Apparently, rumour says, a description of a new wonder material that she was using in her breakthrough computer system. Unfortunately, no copy of the article is known to exist today. So what happened to the Doctor and her new computers? No one knows. BIS have refused to comment. No other articles appeared. The Doctor was literally never seen after she left the university. Some say that BIS have suppressed the new technology, or even suggested that they have sold the technology to a non-human race. Others have said that BIS killed the Doctor to maintain their existing business, but of course the people making those accusations were sued by BIS. Today we can't be sure about any of it. All we do know is that at the time everyone believed that the new computers were a reality. BIS certainly believed it. But now all that is left is the mystery of the missing Doctor and the lost computer technology.
Thanks for the trade, Tuchel. It was a pleasure doing business with you. So long, sucker.
And now we're in the endgame. If you have any thoughts, suggestions, questions or stories, please send them in to behindtheclaw@outlook.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Its home on the web is at behindtheclaw.blogspot.co.uk. Music by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com. I'm your host, Felbrig Napoleon Herriot. Thanks for listening. Prepare for jump.